Hello, this is a podcast from the Freud Museum in London. On the 8th of January 2012, we welcomed writer-in-residence Tim Blake Wurtenbaker as she began a series of talks known as The Graving Tool. First in these talks was a conversation with Michael Pennington and Philip Franks. There will be further podcasts in this series. We hope you enjoy. Thank you.
In terms of working on a character, what have you done? In other words, let's say that you've cast Michael in the Masterfield film. He comes, he's not quite sure what he's going to do. He's very open to it. Have you some idea of what that character is, of whose soulness is? I don't know if we should summarise the play, but I think it'll come, what the play is about will come through. I mean, do you have a clear notion that this is a tormented, how fixed have you?
You have a whole series of questions that you are looking forward to asking, mm-hmm. I think, and a lot of those decisions are made in the casting. You know, we looked high and low to find our Hilda Wangel to be the right Hilda against Michael. If you had cast, say, a less intellectually capable and more abundantly fleshy and sensual Solness, you would cast a very different woman opposite him to be Hilda. With Michael's sort of blazing intellectual curiosity, you needed somebody who would match him, who'd be able to play tennis with him, even though she's a young girl. So I cast Naomi Frederick, who has a wonderful facility, a facility with language and a facility to turn on an emotional sixpence. And there was, I won't mention her, but there was another actress who we nearly cast, but finally we didn't, because she would have needed a different Solness to the one that Michael was, in my head, was going to start investigating. So yes, you do make certain decisions, but you also have to have you cast your actors because you think they're great, and therefore you've got you'll think I trust that you're going to come up with something really interesting that we can then talk about, and talk about at every level and in every way and at every step of the way. That the worst rehearsal periods are ones where you think, I can't go there with you. I can't talk to you about that. That's a horrible feeling. And one of the great joys in working with him is that we can,
Mm-hmm. I want to talk a little bit about your collaboration, because you have indeed collaborated on three plays. Mm-hmm. Two modern plays, two contemporary plays, and The Master Builder by Ibsen's Master Builder, which we'll come back to. What happens, finally... Michael is going to, is presenting one character. It's presenting the case of Master Builder Solness, or Kurt Wengler, or Richard Strauss. Did there come a point in your rehearsals where you didn't see the same person? You didn't see the same character? That you began to feel that Michael was, or you felt that Philip was taking you somewhere which wasn't where you wanted to go in the creation of this?
If there was, I don't remember it, but I suppose that's an easy thing to say. I suppose there must have been times when you watched something I was doing thinking, it might be better for me, for Michael, the Solness, for the scene, for the production, if you took a slightly different decision on that. Inevitably that must have been so. We do have a
some of the taste, yes. Yeah. I suppose with the Furtwängler, which is a play about the denazification program and its effect on the famous conductor of the Berlin Philharmonic, and we meet a redneck, a fierce bigot of an American, who has right on his side, doubtless, because he does not see why anybody should get away with anything because they're elevated by their status as an artist. So he goes out of his way to hammer this famous, revered artist into the ground. And he is a man of great sensibility and enormous arrogance. And there were times when one would see... Furtwängler has extraordinary arias, of course he does, of articulacy and the defence of pure art for its own sake. And there would be times when I would think the temperature is not quite right. The temperature is either too hot or too cold. But at that kind of level, it's the merest tweak on the tiller. And so with the collaboration play, it was it was always best when it was splashy and warm.
The Strauss play,
which didn't reveal itself very easily on the page, did
it?
And the great discovery then, and all I really needed to do was say, yes, please, more of this, was that it became a love story between these two men. It became a wonderful play about friendship, and between Strauss and his wife. To get away from them being famous people and what famous thing they did next in a famous time in history when famous bad men did bad things, and to make it a hot play about people's hearts being available, that was the exciting thing about that, wasn't it?
How constrained were you by the fact that it was a play dealing with a historical character?
Not very, because nobody really knows, unless you looked into it. You probably only have the vaguest impression of what Strauss Wendler was like, or indeed what Richard Strauss was like. And if you look at the film of Strauss, he looks like a bank manager on holiday, and you simply cannot believe this man wrote The Rosenkavalier and the other things that he wrote, this glorious, glorious, erotic music, because he purposely made himself into a bourgeois, and he presents himself in a rather different way from what he was. But most people on the whole don't have a received impression of what such characters are. It's a bit different if you're playing Margaret Thatcher. A serving actor would have to take that on, and did so extraordinarily, as I think you're all about to see. So it depends a bit. I think you're more free, more is more than you think. I do a show about Chekhov. I've got an idea of what Chekhov probably sounded like, and I know what people said about his speaking voice, but not many people know that. If I decide he had a very, very high, squeaky falsetto, who's going to say he didn't? You know, in a way you can treat... you can treat them semi-fictional. Is what I'm saying. And there's also a point when you research real characters, such as the ones we're talking about, when the research has to stop about a couple of weeks before you do the show, because what you're dealing with is not the historical figure, but a writer's version of the historical figure. I'm not sure that Strauss was quite as ebullient generally in life as he was in the play, but didn't artwork in the play. Who's to say he wasn't, you know? So you start inventing it, you start dreaming it up, we can talk about this again. Because we're both using dreaming quite a lot in our conversation. You start inventing, you research up to a point, and then you start making it up.
So to a huge extent, arguably, all art is self-portraiture, isn't it, all the time, in any medium. And there's a hell of a lot of Ronnie Harwood in the character of Richard Strauss, who was in the room being exactly that ebullient, splashy person. But there's also got to be a lot of self-portraiture in the way you played it. Just as we both played Hamlet, there's no point in thinking you're going to play the perfect Hamlet or in measuring yourself against some yardstick of a Hamlet that you admired. It's you. It's how you're doing it. So for me to try and squeeze Michael into being my Hamlet's Holiness is just silly. You know, it's my job is enabling him to do his Hamlet's Holiness in as comfortable and fulfilling and revealing a way as I possibly can.
I mean, we are talking about dreaming or letting the imagination wander, which is, in a way, the opposite of really fixing a character or engraving a character. So how are you balancing that in the rehearsal room, both of you? Because eventually you have to make some decisions. You have to come to some conclusion. You have to also interpret what's, you know, something that Ibsen, in the case of the Master Builder, has written of this man who is going to be able to you know, go to the top and jump or fall, whatever he does. I'm not. So how do you work that?
Well, I think acting and directing are very different activities. Indeed, actually, it's remarkable that someone could do both, because they're intellectually. Well, my job, which is very difficult to talk about in a funny way, acting is a very difficult thing to find a character to talk about, because it's not really an intellectual activity at all. It's a professional discipline. Which leaves a lot of space for dreaming. You know, you gather all the information, you think what the facts of the character are, what the player has given you, and then you're walking down the street one day and you think, actually, I think he walked with a bit of a stoop. You're making it up, rather as you did as a kid, you know, when you were pulling costumes out of the costume bag to dress up for daddy or dress up for mummy. It's Freudian's, you appreciate it. Driving force in acting. You're still showing off in a way. Here I am being someone completely different. And actually, in a funny way, I'm not being silly about this, that is what sustains you. And I think the job of an actor in a rehearsal room is not so much intellectual or tactical as almost feral. You know, you've got to just be intuiting all the time. If you're any kind of intellectual, you leave that part of your brain at the door. Analysis, too much tendency to talk, is not helpful in an actual rehearsal. You know, you've got to... when does it feel right, this line? It feels right, oddly enough, it feels right when I'm standing this close to you, sitting this close to you, I'm sitting 3 feet away from you. It doesn't feel right. So you keep trying all the time, you experiment. That's my view of the job. Now, a director, I think, even while joining in that improvisation and invention, has all the time, I think, got to be thinking of the structure of the scene, the structure of the play, the structure of the act, the relationship with the other actors.
Well, my dream times happen before, to a large extent.
Yeah.
But the director's dream time happens when you're working with a designer, often where, you know, you start with an empty box, or not even a box, just batting ideas to and fro, and that's that part of the process for the director, I think. What music shall I use? What translation shall I commission? How does that work? When Solness talks about the thing that he has inside him, do we use the word troll, you know, or do we, and we risk gales of inappropriate laughter, or do we find something else? Do we find something more vampiric? The fluidity of the creative process for a director happens then. In the rehearsal room, your job is to observe, is to be there and say, yes, I saw what you did. And also, I think, to be in some way multilingual, because all actors work in different ways and at different paces, and you can't expect that they'll all be working in the same way. So you need to be able to understand how, in a room full of 6, 8, 12, 20 actors, what stage they're at any particular point. For instance, I did a production of David Edgar's version of Nicholas Nickleby, the Dickens, and the actors who play Nicholas and Smike, who are in pretty well every scene, Daniel Wayman and David Dawson, work in the most different way it's possible to work, I think. Daniel trained as a research chemist, and he comes in every morning with a handwritten list of 20 questions that he wants to ask you. Just a few points before we start. David Dawson, if you start talking too much, hides under a table, and just does a little drawing of a stick person, and almost like a damaged child. But they're in the scene together, and they have to be working like that all the way through. So your job is a very practical one. It's to be able to know what little thing to give to David and what lengthy response, finely argued response, to give to Daniel to get the scene working. You have to sit back and look, don't you? Whereas acting, as you rightly say, that's disastrous if you're on your own shoulder.
Yeah.
I want to come back to the Master Builder, because there is there's a paper by Freud which I don't understand at all, because nor would I pretend to understand it, but where he talks about Romer's home and talks about the frustration of success. And it seems to me the Master Builder, and indeed When We Dead Awaken, is very much about that. And certainly in the production that I saw that you did in Chichester, that came across very clearly, and the torment of this man was very powerful. I wonder if you could just talk about that, whether you discussed that among, you know, whether that came up or what... as you were working on it. This is a slightly off, you know, slightly...
I remember we'd had a talk 2 or 3 weeks before we started. I can't get this character, really. Philip, I don't get this about the song. So, okay, so he's an extremely successful architect. He's in his 60s. He's renowned internationally. He's a vast success, idolised and fated wherever he goes. He's given 50 years of his life to let out life to the arts. He's now seeing a new generation coming up behind him, of which he's instinctively jealous and paranoically afraid, because they don't think, he doesn't think that they respect him enough and won't even know him in the street. I said, how do I begin on this? Philip said, you spent 50 years in the theatre working in the arts. Generations coming, need I say more? Go figure. And it was, that's right, absolutely. I mean, what Ibsen catches, of course he does, because it was also his at his ground level. You know, what happens to you when you've achieved everything you thought you needed to achieve? Are you recognised not only by your peers, but to the next generation coming up? Are you desperately trying to seek approval with, you know, inappropriate love affairs and all sorts of things, which in a way Solness does do? Does he then lose his head so badly when a young woman who he thinks is going to despise him turns out to be such an enthusiast that he builds an impossible spine, climbs up it and falls off? Same in When We Dead Awaken, a sculptor at the end of his life who realises he married the wrong woman because he didn't sort of get who he married. He should have stayed true to the relationship, the finished, or perhaps unfinished relationship he'd had 30 years before. I forgot why I've started this. but it's to do with, it's not very difficult to imagine that if you work in the arts.
No, that the overarching thing of what the architecture means for him and why he finally climbs up and leaps or falls to his death. Oddly, that's not hard. What's harder is the rag and bone shop of the heart in the play, the minutiae of what's going on in his marriage, yeah. the buried histories, the history of what his relationship with Hilda Weingel actually is. You know, is it actually a story of buried child abuse? What does he hate his wife or love her? If so, why? Is it guilt or hatred? Is it resentment or not? But these are questions that it's a joy to work on. You know, every play, every script is like walking out onto a frozen lake, isn't it? And most television scripts, you take two steps out and it starts to crack under your feet, and you scuttle for the safety of the shore. The better the play, the further out you can walk, and the more exciting and exhilarating it becomes. Or to drag in another metaphor, George Devine, I think. Had that thing that we came up with rehearsals, that somebody said it to you, that working on Ibsen is like digging for potatoes. that you have this apparently muddy field, and then the more you dig, the more wonderful things start to come up. You know, we've all seen bad productions of Ibsen, where you think this one really is a terrible play. This is a terrible. You know, some of the others are good, but this one's terrible. Hush, isn't that the orphanage burning? You know, and that is really, that's only the surface. As T.S. Eliot says of Johnson, the high polish of the surface of his plays reflects nothing but the lazy reader's fatuity, and, which is very bracing. But the more you work on Ibsen, you think, oh God, no, there's something more under there. And look, it's alive and nutritious. Can you do the potato metaphor? So yeah, it's difficult, but God, it's fun, isn't it? Working on it.
Yeah. He's fascinated with subconscious, isn't he? Mm. This is interesting because of the timing of when he lived in Freud. Of course, he's fascinated by it, instinctively fascinated, and he's also fascinated by the relationships, particularly between men and women. And if you dig under his last play, When We Dare Awaken, which appears to be highly expressionistic, highly symbolic, highly poetic, almost completely unbelievable from a realistic point of view, you dig a bit deeper, and the potatoes that come up is the relationship with the younger wife, whom he doesn't love, the relationship with the woman who's his contemporary, whom he broke up with years ago, whom he'll never be free of. I mean, all the things that keep people in the theatre.
Which is why they survive, isn't it? And the melodrama is simply the surface. The melodrama is just... is of the time. The grandeur of Ibsen is the psychological accuracy and surprise.
Yeah, called the first Freudian of the theatre, yeah. I mean, which is interesting. But I want to ask you, Michael, now to compare, I mean, doing Shakespeare, which is when there was no Freud, to doing a more modern play from Ibsen on.
Well,
as an actor, and then, yeah.
Well, when you read Shakespeare, you actually think Freud must have been alive, because there it is, all them, a lot of it is there, just because the part of it that's to do with deep instinct and understanding of the human psyche, no question. The difference really is in the delivery of Shakespeare, you know. There's a predicated form, and I suppose in musical terms it could be compared to Bach, well, it varies very much, the verse form, the way the verse is structured, which creates character on the hoof, if that means anything at all. The first and foremost thing you've got to do in Shakespeare is keep talking, if you've got talking to do. You can't take the great pauses. You're dead if you're not speaking or listening very closely. There's no such thing as the naturalistic pause, the naturalistic, or very rarely, the naturalistic hesitation, such as what I just did then, but slightly forgetting what I was going to say. None of that applies. What you've got to do is deliver those five beats to the bar, line, well, five bars to the line, actually, or whatever it is you have to do. And then characters emerge, because that was his amazing gift. Nowadays, you get scripts, post-Freudian dramatists, with few exceptions, generally, you're given a little adverb before your speech saying how you're going to do it, angrily, hesitating, as if you didn't have to work it out yourself. You know? And that's the trick. David Mamet doesn't do that, but a lot of dramatists do. And always adverbs to describe the emotional state, which aren't going to come out automatically. You have to decide what to invest the lines with, rather than letting the lines take those decisions for you. In Shakespeare, you will find a line of blank verse which somehow has got an extra half beat in it. So there's a little jolt, a little syncopation in it. It's always there for a reason. It's there because the speaker suddenly loses confidence in what he has to say or isn't comfortable in some way or another. or there are lines of complete monosyllables, sometimes three or four of them in a row. Think of Hamlet, who at the climax of his tragedy of his struggle says, "I do not know why yet I live to say this things to do, sith I have cause and will and strength and means to do it." And all the books about Hamlet have been written, all the theories have been pronounced. That's his problem. He knows he's got a job, so he doesn't know how to do it, and Shakespeare gives you this staccato, monosyllabic fusillade of words. And of course they're monosyllabic for a reason. He does it for you a lot of the time.
Exactly. Similarly, if you look at Leontes in The Winter's Tale, who speaks in the most clotted, knotted, drop knitting way, because his thoughts are absolutely tied up with each other, doing himself and everybody around him incredible damage. And when this knitting is unravelled, so his language unravels, and he looks at the miracle of his wife returned to life and says, "If this be magic, let it be an art lawful as eating," which is the simplest way of putting the most extraordinary, miraculous, numinous thing. What we think of as subtext, what we all bang on about the subtext, is simply contained in the way this incredible genius places his words next to each other.
Yeah. So is the notion of character, do you think, different or the same? I mean, are you saying that it is really... has been no change, that the modern life has brought no change in our notion of what a character is?
I think it has, but the thing to say about this is that Shakespeare, the word character to Shakespeare meant one thing only, and it's handwriting. So when Claudius gets a letter from Hamlet, it's just Hamlet's character, and Laertes understands he's talking about his handwriting. Character as a personality, an investigation of nature, the word didn't mean that for Shakespeare. Character is something, I don't know what the origin of the word is in this sense, but it's got to be much later than that. Now, since Stanislavski's teaching, which is the sort of early part of the last century, we're all obsessed with character. How do I find the character? How do I look for the character? No, I think that what Freud and in professional terms Stanislavski and what Chekhov and Ibsen have given to drama is indeed an absolutely fascinating, like free-form music. It's a free-form music, or it's Stravinsky as opposed to Bach, whatever your image might be. I wouldn't want to say that nothing had been discovered, not at all. I mean,
it's a huge dilemma, though, for the modern actor, isn't it?
Yes, it is. The training is
in turmoil because of that. I think. Yeah. I think a lot of young actors, particularly Rado's, that's the drama school I know best, spend an enormous amount of time working on their characters, and that can be absolutely deadly. It can be that they go away and they invent where they were born and what they like to eat and what they did this morning, and they come in with these books filled, like the book of the English Patient, filled with research, which is useless when you're playing the scene because they don't have the ability to listen and work on the line. However, David Mamet has written a very bracing book about this, where he says when you leave the stage you go into the wings. That's the only place you go. You don't go to Moscow, you go into the wings. That's a bucket of water in the face. You try and steer a middle way, don't you? Ideally, you mine the text for whatever potatoes, whatever the image is, as much as you possibly can. But then, at the end, we are post-Freudian people. We have to, if we're doing The Master Builder, speculate on what the nature of the sexual relationship between Solness and Hilda is. We have to. You can't not. You've been Solness not to.
Whereas in Hamlet, nobody finds out whether Hamlet and Ophelia have slept together or not. Strangely enough, he's just left. Shakespeare didn't bother to tell you. That wasn't his interest, really. The emotions were, whether or not they were provoked by that were what interested him. So he didn't... He's also a cheat, Shakespeare. He's a terrible cheat. I mean, he abandons what we would call character completely if he senses a good joke, usually a rude one, and if he senses a good bit of poetry. So suddenly Gertrude, who in Hamlet comes on and describes Ophelia's drowning, famous speech, "There is a willow grows in Slanderbrook," absolutely astoundingly beautiful. There's been no sign in the play up till then that she would ever be capable of putting four words together. But Shakespeare smells a good description into Gertrude. Now we think, how is it that she's... What's happened to her character?
I is the correct to give her a bottle of gin to hold and all is revealed.
And then you go, maybe she pushed Ophelia in and she's putting a tremendous gloss on it. I've been there. So that's the kind of daftness you get into.
We could spend a lot of time talking about language and the change of language, but I'm going to go in the opposite direction because I want to talk about physicality. And I'm going to start, this is a loaded question, because I want to start about how you, whether it's Shakespeare or a modern character, how you work on the physicality of the character, because that is, you know, that is finally what we see on stage. I mean, we notice that, and that to me is what is always exciting in the theatre, that it will change from moment to moment, from night to night. How do you work on that? And you particularly, Michael, I mean, they say British actors can't act physically. Actually, British actors, good ones, are extremely physical, but it's very subtle. It isn't a lot of leaping around. It's a subtle movement. How do you work on that?
First of all, just very practically, I mean, there's certain information you're given. If you're playing Coriolanus, the great warrior who can, or Hector in Troilus and Cressida, who can fight off, you know, 18 Greeks with one sword, then it's pretty, and you have an idea the designer's not going to give you, you know, padded shoulders, but probably one of those skimpy little Trojan things. It stands to reason you're going to have to do a bit of this, doesn't it, if you're going to be convincing the part. You know, there are certain things that you see are inevitably going to be necessary, otherwise people say, well, you can fight a battle. So that's the simple level. The second level, which is, it's actually a question you should ask someone like Anthony Scher, who, after all, is an artist, and I think sketches very frequently. I think he did a book which is full of sketches of his Richard III when he played that extraordinarily physical part. And he clearly is someone who, whether visually or, in fact, literally, does sketches of a character in order to get himself to where he wants to. I don't have the gift of sketching, so I can't do that. But you sometimes notice people in the tube and think, that's funny how he sits, you know, how he sits, how he does that with his foot. What's it mean? Maybe that's what I would do, because I'm a little hesitant about something that carries. You know, you're a sort of scavenger. You're scavenging all the time for details and stuff to put together.
With Solness, we spent quite a lot of time discussing what jacket he might wear.
Oh,
I remember. I mean, it sounds terribly trivial, but actually it really isn't. Because if he comes on smart, what statement does that make about the meeting he's just been to? If he comes on all dishevelled, that makes a completely different statement. Yeah. Does he have a jacket that, which we eventually hit on, one that he might well have sort of customised himself so that he can have a drawing book and pens and the accoutrements of his trade or his art, so he becomes his own calling card? That's a physical choice, and a really good designer is vital there. Not a designer who's going to impose some huge concept on you, but one who is really going to listen to what you need. I worked with the designer Ray Smith on T.S. Eliot's Cocktail Party, and she just didn't do anything for weeks and weeks and weeks, to the extent that I was going up the wall thinking, when are we going to get something? Costume design, something, something, something. But what she was doing was listening and watching, and then one day she came in and presented a piece of jewellery to Maggie Steed, who was playing Julia in the Cocktail Party, in a box, and said, do you think this maybe is the sort of thing that Julia might wear? And you could almost see the light bulb going off on top of Maggie's head, because it was a bejeweled lizard, and Maggie had been thinking that maybe she'd spent some time in the desert, and, you know, maybe this was something that had sparked off something that had led to how she wanted to lead her life and helping other people. It all sorts of connections just going bang, 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 bang. But it was instinctive and artistic, you know, not wholly intellectual. But certainly the physicality of the work is contained in the props, in where somebody in a room chooses to put her chair. You know, that it's of vital importance.
So I want to ask you, because I wanted to ask you about the difference, but particularly with you. I mean, Michael has directed, but you have been very much an actor and very much a director. Do you have to change personalities, or do you have to change character when you do one or the other?
Yeah.
And how do you change? I mean, how do you... And is that difficult sometimes? Do you ever slip back into...
No, very rarely. The shortcut trivial explanation is that if you're an actress, like we were talking earlier on about Meryl Streep giving interviews now, where she's saying, well, you know, say what you like about Thatcher, she was, you know, she was strong woman, blah, blah, blah. Now, actually, I don't care about that at all. What's interesting about that is the fact that Meryl Streep is seeing Thatcher through her own eyes, which is what you have to do as a performer. And as a director, you have to not. You know, I played Hector in The History Boys recently, and you know, he's undoubtedly has inappropriate sexual feelings towards boys. I can't go down the route of thinking, you know, is he right, is he wrong? You know, what he just is, that is what he feels. So you're trying to see the world through Hector's eyes and walk in Hector's shoes. And as the director, you're absolutely the reverse. You're trying to see the world from above. And how you sitting in that chair is going to be affected if your wife comes through that door or if she comes through that door.
What do you feel, I'm going to ask this both of you, what do you feel about the emergence and dominance of puppets in contemporary theatre? Has this been spoken about?
She said there was going to be a puppet question.
Puppets? We've spoken about language, we've spoken about physicality, and yet puppets are dominating the theatre.
Which theatre?
So, and you've actually acted with puppets. Yes. Like, I was thinking
never
about
act with puppets
that.
Or dogs or children. No, it's true. Yes, sorry.
I mean, how does that? I mean, does that throw up? I mean, does that completely contradict everything, all the work that you know that has been happening with actors for a century? Or is it? I mean, have
not entirely. You know? I mean, if you look at War Horse, in which the puppets were very much the only thing worthwhile about the enterprise.
I'm glad you said it. I didn't say it.
The work of the puppets was absolutely parallel to the delight one gets from a really good piece of art. Or look, I made a hat where there never was a hat. Look, this thing made of wire and leather straps appears to be breathing, frightened, joyful, leaping, and it's all being done in front of your very eyes by some people, and that's exactly the same as any art.
So you feel? Do you feel the same, Michael? Having
my experience of it was working with very tiny war horses in a version of Venus and Adonis, the Shakespeare poem, which was sort of presented in triple style. There was a solo guitarist, and there were puppeteers with puppets, various kinds of puppets, desk puppets, marionettes, big huge puppets, and there was me narrating the poem. Most improbable success, I must say. I mean, most improbable thing to try and do. I know it was crazy. But it worked beautifully, it has to be said. That's a love story. Venus and Adonis, of course, Venus is a goddess of love, Adonis is a beautiful young man. These puppets, which were maybe 3 foot high, I thought, but she's breathing. I mean, she looked like Helen Mirren, Venus. And you couldn't take your eyes off her as a man, I can tell you. I mean, but that's because she's alive. She's been, well, to a puppeteer, it's easy. They just do a little thing all the time. So the thing's constant. It's never still a puppet. You know, it's always just doing something or other that just suggests that it's very simple from a puppeteer's point of view. But that was such a unique thing. I don't know what it contributes to our discussion in a way. It was a charming and delightful thing. I don't know that you understood the poems better as a result. I don't. It was just a sort of new little mini art form of its own.
We love to marvel at skill.
Yes, that's right.
But it's not the same. That's what I'm trying to.
I mean, when Peterborough brought circus skills to bear on Midsummer Night's Dream, we understood. We understood what magic was and the way that we hadn't with gauzy wings and wands, because we're thinking, look at that! My God, that's amazing! Oh, I see. That's what magic is. And then it became a cliche, and everybody did circuses. Mm. And likewise, aerialism was very in at the RSC a couple of years ago. Everybody's forever falling from the sky. and the first time you saw it, you thought, wow, how wonderful, we're using that dimension. And then we thought, aerialism again. And it's possible that puppets are going the same way.
Yeah.
Where, you know, we've done puppets a bit. Mm. What next?
So taking our work, that's the problem.
Well, I'm going to open... I'm sure you have lots of questions, and I'm going to open now the discussion to anyone who wants to ask either Philip or Michael anything about their approach to character, or indeed anything else about working in the theatre, or anything.
Anything. I wanted to ask whether something happened. You said that Shakespeare was cheap. Along came a possibility for a piece of poetry or a joke, and he just put it in, and you just have to do it. Does it ever happen that you've gone to all this trouble to discover your character, find the right jacket for him, know where he's going to sit and where he is for the next entrance, but there's a joke that you could make? I mean, is there ever a collision, as it were, between some sort of theatrical moment that you might feel was very good for the scene, which is not much to do with character. It's to do with...
I think one will often look at a piece of work and think, yeah, you wanted to be loved there, didn't you? Or you wanted the gag, you wanted that so badly.
Well, a piece of business that you...
Yes. Inevitably. You know, it's... We're not priests.
Far from it, and there is a thing called going for a laugh. Going for the laugh, you know, where the truth of the situation is slightly compromised by a bit of funny business, because we do love to hear laughter.
There's a wonderful essay in that there's a series of books we both contributed to, published by the University of Birmingham, called Players of Shakespeare, and there's a chapter by Donald Sinden, which makes marvellously refreshing reading. Everyone's just banging on about the holiness of their art and how they discovered this, and you know, it was like a bolt from God. He rates his laughs on a scale of 1 to 10, and you know, eventually he checks his watch, looks at the sundial, moves the sundial, and leaves. 10 and exit round. Yeah. There's got to be some of that. There has got to be.
That's what Max Miller did, after all. Yeah. I mean, it's vaudeville, lives and breathes in the theatre. But it's, you know, you've got to be a little disciplined about it, haven't you?
Of course you have. But it works both ways. You know, we were again talking earlier on the recent adaptation of Great Expectations on the television. Suffered, they're very fine in many ways, suffered tremendously from not allowing the existence of humour at all. You know, so it was just relentlessly serious. And that's not what Dickens is. You know, Dickens illuminates his darkness, but by his extraordinary wit, and so you're really belittling him by just going for the one.
Does that answer, or do you mean that you might even sacrifice?
I knew that's what they were going to say. Yeah. It answers it perfectly.
But it answers it because yeah.
They do. They cheat.
Yeah. Any other questions?
Well, I'd like to ask a question to all three of you, really. I mean, as a writer, you hand your work over to a director, and then, in a way, you work with your actors, but you also, in some way, hand it to them, your vision, because presumably you start with a kind of vision. But what happens when there is a collision between you and you don't like what a director is doing, and you don't like what your actors are doing, or you don't like what your director is telling you?
It's horrible.
I mean, who wins in these occasions, or how do you deal
depends
with it?
Depends how famous and successful.
Depends where the money is. It's a very good question, though, because, of course, yeah, sometimes it is hell, actually. I mean, as an actor, I was remind myself that the last port of call in the process is the actor on the stage in front of the audience. And once you're there, no one can stop you doing what you want to do. Which is a liberty I hope never to abuse, but it is the fact of the matter. And the director's sitting up there saying,
I think I can just bring the figure of death on at the back here. Yes. That'll fix it.
That's right. So, you know, in a way we have, you have to negotiate your way through that all.
It's rare when it does go wrong.
But does it necessarily result in a worse production? I mean, couldn't it in a way... I mean, often I assume plays are, you know, critically praised in disguise, and when you get on the stage, no one knows that behind the scenes it's been terrible.
Well, I think there's good... Well, I think there is good friction, probably, and destructive friction, and I think there is a lot of, in my experience, maybe in my rehearsal rooms, there is friction, there is disagreement, but there is a difference between a kind of searching for something.
I don't thrive on it, and the best directors I've worked with as an actor don't thrive on it either. I mean, Trevor Nunn, who's the best director I've worked with, there are never riots in his rehearsal rooms. Never. There just aren't. I mean, every so often somebody will moan in the pub, but generally speaking, the atmosphere in the rehearsal, but Roger Michel, likewise, the atmosphere is one of, well, okay, if you disagree with that, what do you think? Let's try this. Whereas, you know, somebody digging their heels in, it's what I meant when I was trying to talk about the beginning of the rehearsal period and how counterproductive fear is. Well, I think the same goes for anger, that people take up entrenched positions and then you lose the ability to open.
Yes, and I suppose the talent for a director is, for an actor, look, I want to stand on my head in this bit. You say, well, there's no reason to stand on your head. Should we have a row about whether I should stand on my head in the scene? I think I should, you think I shouldn't. I suppose part of you says, well, let's just put that to bed for a bit, and we'll come back to it later. in the third week. At which point, I will come to Philip and say, you know how you asked me to stand on my head? That's a bad idea. With a bit of luck.
It's all, given that Shakespeare does everything better than anybody else, and before everybody else, it's in Midsommar's Dream, this Bottom, the terrible actor who you, your worst nightmare in a rehearsal room is Bottom. I can do this, I can do that, I can do your part, my part is Bottom. Says something, you know, some terrible idea about staging, and Quince, the eternal director, goes, aye, or else. I cheer inwardly whenever I hear that.
They'll speak some more of this director, yeah, as I told you.
Well, you're talking about the transition that you make, or the difference, not more the difference between being an actor, having an actor's mind, and having a director's mind. And I was wondering what advice you would offer someone who's making that transition at the moment, and how you find it yourself.
Try it out. Do it. Going way back to the, you know, if I can boil down what Michael said at the beginning to don't talk about it, do it. You know, you can waste a lot of time and ruin a lot of work by over-talking it. If you want to try it, try it. It's what happened to me. I'd acted for years and years and years and years and years, and then I was in a production of As You Like It, which was not good at all, and I was sitting around moaning in the green room like actors do, saying, he can't bloody direct traffic, you know, how dare he say this? And my dear friend Francis Matthews, who ran Greenwich Theatre at the time, heard this conversation and gave me a real talking to, the kind of you only get from a really good friend. They said, look, do not do that. Don't be one of those actors who sits around moaning about other directors. If you think you could do it better, do it better. I will give you a production. And this was the gift that you don't normally get. He said, I'll give you a production. And if it all goes wrong, I'll be there as your safety net. And the one advice I would give you is that your first bit of directing, don't choose to play with too many relationships. and he's plumb right. Don't do Chekhov just because you worship Chekhov as a god.
I'm doing Chekhov, but it's fine.
Short play's fine. Yeah. But don't do the Cherry Orchard, which is the best play ever written, possibly outside Shakespeare, because it's so goddamn complicated.
Yeah.
But you know, if you have any inkling towards it at all, just do it. And then, you know, you might not like it, or you might love it. And it might be a sort of terrible, you know, second drag on a cigarette, and you think, I love cigarettes. And they love me, and they're good for me. So cigarettes all the way from here on.
So we spoke to an actor and director about the creation of characters, but how does a writer start to create a character?
A little bit. It was interesting for me listening to them both, because it's a combination of both. I mean, there's a lot of dreaming and wandering around and sort of having a vague sense of things. And then eventually you have to, as a writer, stand outside a little bit and sort of orchestrate it a little bit. I mean, really decide, because eventually, if you're writing for the stage, people have to come on and off. I mean, it's quite technical. And they have to have a reason to come on, and they have to have a reason to say something. And so that is a little bit like the director when you get... But before that, I think you've tried... I mean, I don't know quite how actors work, but it's a little bit of that. It's a kind of dream thing, and it's also observing people in the tube or something. It's a combination of a lot of things. So it seems to combine, as far as I understand it, you know, both elements. I think that's as much as I can answer. So
thank you.
You've
got that wonderful portrait of Freud looking down at you. And I wondered what acting has done for you as a person.
Acting, not very much. Directing's done much more, I think. I think I was a rather neurotic and worrity as an actor. I've become much more confident, and I think probably a bit nicer. Certainly nicer to directors, if I'm acting, because I think, well, you don't have all the answers, and you're probably just as terrified as I am. So let's just try it. Whereas before, I think I was quite, well, why not? Come on, why not? Why not? Why not? Why isn't it working? You choose. You tell me. I find things like this much less intimidating than I would have done before I started directing, because as a director, you're talking to a room full of people all the time.
But I meant in the profession of acting, where you've got to study character and study motive, possibly, how that's affected.
Well, has the one illuminated the other?
Yes.
No, I don't think so particularly. I think you just adjust your perspective. You know, they're the same. That you're still you. You know, it's like cooking or driving. You know, you just use different bits of yourself at different times. No, I'm not sure that the. I just think I've maybe relaxed a bit as an actor since starting to direct, because it's easier.
I think it's quite. I think something different. I think it's quite beneficial being an actor. With a bit of luck, if things go reasonably well and you don't fall prey to too much bitterness and all those negative things that unfortunately a lot of profession does, but if you've done okay and done the kind of work you wanted to, I think it makes you more tolerant, because you're all the time looking at, or in relationships perhaps a little bit more understanding, or you're always looking for motive. Why are you doing that with your finger? Is it because I'm making you nervous or embarrassed? I mean, it potentially makes you much more generous, because you're interested in other people, you're interested in characters, and that means everyone in here as well. So I can't help feeling that's a beneficial thing. We still have a reputation for being rather vain and self-absorbed. It's not a quality that I've seen much among colleagues. I've been very lucky. I've found actors 99% of the time over the last how many years it is, naturally generous, naturally supportive, naturally affectionate. It's my favourite community. So I slightly beat the drum more for the beneficial effects of the job. I mean, it is obviously perilous in the extreme. It's like alarming, it's economically alarming. Because it's competitive, you can fall victim to certain forms of schadenfreude, which are not good for the soul. But you can do good. You can do good. You can entertain. And at some level, with a bit of luck. And if you can do that, you can take pride in it.
The danger is that you don't have it. You can, it is possible for an actor to spend many, many years having and taking no responsibility for their own actions. And that's a shame, you know, for anybody. You know, that's what growing up is, isn't it? And it's perfectly possible to remain quite childish as an actor, I think.
In some ways, rather necessary.
Mm.
Childlike,
yes, a good fine distinction. Yeah.
There is something that I've always wondered about, which is because, I mean, when I do some translation, and certainly when I translate, I find that I pick up very much the mood of the writer I'm translating. Mm. And I sometimes wonder, you know, when you're acting a particularly difficult part or, you know, particular kind of character, how much of that lives with you during the day as long as you're performing in it? And is that quite difficult sometimes, quite uncomfortable? I mean, it's a kind of double life, which is...
Yeah, I think it varies. I think for some people it probably does. I mean, I think acting's driven some actors mad. I think it drove Montgomery Clift mad, for instance. I think it drove MacReady mad, as a matter of fact, and various others, Edmund Kean as well. I think it's a problem of mine, which may mean that I'm just very glib. You know, I don't start thinking about the show in the evening till 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And then I think, well, maybe happened last night that wasn't so good, could be fixed something else, could be changed something else, and give myself a little talking to about what's to be done. But Olivier used to say this. He said, don't take it home with you. You know, whatever happened, don't take it home with you, because then you're moving over the border and your life is going to get affected. Try and keep it. And he, of all people, who was a 24-hour workaholic, you know, he said, otherwise your family's going to suffer, your life is going to suffer. You've got to be able to close the door on it, even after the worst performance you think you've ever given. So you're not going to be able to fix anything before the morning. You know. So I think people are different in that way. Some people find it difficult to live with having a talent for acting. Other people find it quite easy. Mm.
Is it that
a question about translation? Philip referred earlier to part of the concept of a play, like the Master Builder, for example, being to choose the translation. And I noticed that very often with, you know, say, Ibsen or Chekhov, what one gets is a version by rather than a translation by.
That's covering their backs because they don't speak Norwegian.
Well, yeah, but you're also getting a sort of mediation as well. Taking the example of not using the word troll, perhaps, for example, where people might find that difficult, where you wouldn't do that with Shakespeare, would you?
If you were German, you probably would. Mm-hmm. If you were translating it the other way, you would.
Yeah.
But I think that's just one of the things of translation, isn't it? That you have to make choices. And you know, I saw a production of The Master Builder in the West End where Solness said, you know, I intend to discover my inner troll. And it was greeted with gales of laughter, almost inevitably. And it's so not what he means. He's not. He really isn't going for the laugh there. I think, you know, you get that laugh and you're at your peril. And what David Edgar did was to try and work out, yes, it is mediation to some extent, but to work out what Ibsen is talking about. And he's talking about a dark and animalistic and subterranean and damaging supernatural creature. And the way David went was towards vampirism, which was, you know, current at the time, a lot of vampire writing, and is something that although we still, you know, it's still in our culture and not entirely in an amusing and trivialised way. So we were trying to be faithful rather than trying to shift it, I think. I mean, the part of the thing about going for Ibsen is to avoid the, well, I assure you, my dear fellow, the situation is really quite other school of translation, you know, which nobody probably even said then, but they certainly don't say now, without putting in loads of swearing, you know.
Translation fashion, as indeed the language and what people expect, it changes very quickly, doesn't it? I mean, you could say that all classics need retranslating every 10 years, because the very thing that you're talking about perhaps was true of a particular time, but we just don't have the patience for that kind of formal speech. And how much a modern sensibility tends to use modern phrasing to replace the Ibsen. I mean, it's a tricky area, this, isn't it? If it jars on the audience, or jars on every member of the audience, it may jar on some or on others, then you probably made a mistake. But it is tricky, because it's always got to be reviewed, isn't that right?
Yeah.
I mean, you translated Racine, for instance, into French. I mean, how much do you let modern style, modern language into those? I mean, it's a highly formal.
But everyone can make a different decision. I think that, again, mm-hmm. that's the freedom of the translator. I mean, I kept it very formal because it's a slightly different thing with Racine, because a little bit like Shakespeare, mm-hmm. it happens as you're speaking. There's nothing else, and therefore, in fact, Racine, really, you have to translate line by line, or you miss what's going on, because nothing. I mean, it's the opposite of the talking cue. You know, you get things get much worse. It's, you know, the more you say, the worse it gets. But you have to be, what is said has to be there and has to be accurate. But that's a constraint with Racine. It's not necessarily so with the Greek play. I think that's something about how audiences, a play that's translated is translated for a contemporary audience, and therefore I agree it has to speak, it has to be. We can't make the kind of an allowance you make, for example, for Shakespeare, where you have that language in your history, and therefore it has to be contemporary. And I think 10 years, 15 years is about right for any translation. They are. Because by then, an audience hears differently. We speak differently, but also
slang dates
and phraseology, or just the use of a word. Marika, you have a question back. You had a
sorry. Yes, now I just wondered if, just as an actor, you put yourself into a character that you play, and that character is born again every time a new actor takes that role on, to a certain extent. How much does it go the other way, if at all? I.e., do you find as actors that the characters you play, particularly if you play them for a lengthy run, become part of you and change you to a degree? Or is it just as simply that you impose yourself on a character from ever the other way around?
Everyone's looking at you, Philip.
I played a policeman on television for 4 years. It affects me not one jot.
But that's possibly a reflection on the part.
Playing Hamlet affects you, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. Playing Hamlet does affect you. It affects you in many ways, but not least because there's. I don't know whether you. I'm sure you did feel this, Michael. But the bereavement of when it's over. It's horrible when it's over. You're living with the best. You're saying the most important things in the best way possible every night, and it's ghastly when it stops.
Yeah.
Are there particular, I mean, besides Hamlet, can you name some parts which are particularly, that you, well, regretted stopping, or which have affected you in some way?
Almost everyone, actually. I mean, if it's gone at all well, almost any Shakespeare. I mean, Timon was the last Shakespeare I did, Timon of Venice, which is unusual, and I think is a wonderful play psychologically, by the way. Absolutely fantastic, as it were, proto-Freudian study of what you might call the vanity of benevolence. I mean, it was just fascinating. I was so sorry to finish it. One of the worst things that can happen is when you think the show is good and you've done well, but for one reason or another, it closes after a month. You know, it does 25 performances in the repertoire of the National, the RSC, and that's it, because families are complicated. And I think, well, we've stopped before we got going. I mean, the Master Builder, we rehearsed, I think, for 5 weeks and played for four. Yeah. I was inclined to think that if you play something for a less long a time than you rehearsed it, it's not quite worth it, you know, which is silly. But I felt we could have taken that to another stage.
It hadn't fit, it wasn't run dry, certainly.
Not at all, no, it was still sopping. Yeah. So, but you usually regret for those reasons. Maybe I'm not method enough, I don't think I get affected too much.
It was a question from Mike, just that at one point you said as an actor you need to leave your intellect at the door, which I always thought was important to an actor, and I'm not sure now if maybe I was confusing that for empathy.
Yeah, I'm using language rather loosely when I say that, leave your intellect at the door. You can't do that, obviously. There's a thing called, you know, it's active intellect. There's a difference in intelligence, isn't there, which is emotionally based anyway, and you know, sort of intelligent approach to how you're playing a scene is one thing. The tendency to sit and theorise about what it means in the historical sequence of 19th century drama before you get up and actually try your bit of it is not terribly helpful. There's different kinds of analysis. It's perfectly true that when you encounter a problem in a rehearsal, which maybe you can't resolve by the end of the day, you need to go and think about it, you're going to have to apply some kind of analytical ability to what it is that's wrong, like diagnosing an illness or an indisposition, but trying to work out where we went wrong with it. So to that extent, an actor has to be able to do that as well. But the best moments to me, and I think that's in a way all I'm saying, the best moments of all are when you find things improvisationally or almost by chance, guided no doubt by the enormous amount of information you've by that stage got about the character and so forth, when you suddenly do something very, very free. I mean, those are the thrilling moments, aren't they? No, you do, of course, you have to.
But they're free because of the work you've done.
Yeah.
I worked on a television series, a Dickens series, some years ago, a version of Martin Chuzzlewit, in which Paul Scofield, now largely forgotten by young actors, certainly, tragedies, certainly, I mean, one of the, if not the most remarkable actors I've ever seen or worked with, had a scene at the end of this series as old Martin Chuzzlewit. It's sort of Prospero-like, where he comes, he throws off his disguise, he comes back to life, he dispenses reward and punishment to basically the entire cast. So, therefore, it was the most enormously long speech. And Scofield had worked harder at the script than I've ever seen anybody work at anything. He'd read the entire book, 500-600 pages out loud to his wife over a period of many, many months. He knew it inside out, back to front. I mean, he could have gone on Mastermind and cruised it on this. And when it came to filming, he was as free as a bird. He every take, he was going somewhere slightly different. And it was never wrong, because the scaffolding and structure was so secure.
Yeah,
that's
I just wanted to say, as regarding the Thatcher film, I think I don't have any subjects that are taboo for me, but I cannot go and see that film. I saw Meryl Streep interviewed this morning, and she said that when she was asked what she knew about Thatcher, she said very little. And at the beginning, and I thought, well, possibly that's probably why you were able to play her. And I'm sure that she gives a magnificent performance. But I mean, last night I was at a production of The Riots that's transferred from the Tricycle. And it was so informative about what was actually happening in a place like Tottenham. And when you've lived through, when you know that the social fabric of the country was completely ripped out so destructively, so decisively, so purposefully, then for me, I don't think I could ever see it.
So you wouldn't be able to see a film about Cameron either, perhaps?
No, it's not same. Because right. she was the actual me. I mean, Blair, the whole follow-on. I'm not saying
that. I mean, are you saying that you couldn't watch... You're not saying because you couldn't... You don't think it's right to make a film about a woman with dementia who's still living, which is what some people are saying.
No, it's not about...
You're talking about the politics.
It's because, actually, there are a lot of people with dementia, elderly people who are in care homes that are not being looked after because there's no funding for them. So it's very sad if anyone has dementia. For me, it's not about that. I mean, maybe, personally for me, in a way, it's very challenging because I certainly, at this time, couldn't go and see it. I don't know if I ever will be able
because,
to.
Sorry to chase you down on this, but because the subject and what she brought to the country is too painful
for
me.
It's too painful for me. And not only what she did at the time, but the legacy of that.
Well, that means some subjects are taboo. I mean, that means Macbeth perhaps ought to be taboo, or Richard III. I mean, even if people have done unspeakable wickedness, is it wrong to dramatise them, necessarily? Would you feel... can you imagine at all, and I'm just saying this as the devil's advocate in a way, being moved by the fact that she has now lost her way, that she's old and out of control, and may have regrets about some things she's done that are probably not enough. Are you saying you wouldn't be able to respond to that side of the film, however well Meryl Streep played it?
I think I'm sure that I could appreciate Meryl Streep's brilliance in portraying her. I suppose in a way I question why the film is being made now. And I don't think, from what I understand, there hasn't been enough, I mean, the actual effects of what she... I take your point about Macbeth and... But of course, those people are long dead, and I don't. I just think it's very.
Please
go on. No, we can.
No, I think there was a thought about it being, and you may not respect this. The thought about it, that there's an aspect to a story which is like that of a female King Lear, which therefore is an interesting subject for a drama. Mm-hmm. King Lear did unspeakable damage, also in a sense in the fictional world of his play. But there doesn't seem to me, well, there obviously isn't anything wrong with making a play about King Lear. I think I must say that when Meryl Streep says she didn't know much about Thatcher, what she will have meant is actually what Philip was saying earlier. From the point of view of acting her, she didn't know enough about her character, her motives, her psychology, to be able to play her satisfactory when she started and learnt. It's not that she was ignorant about the Thatcher years in Britain, I don't think, because she read every piece of material that was available. She studied it intensively, just as she studied the voice and the body. I know that, I can testify to that. But she may have been meaning it in a specialised actor sense of saying, well, I don't know enough empathetically about her to be able to do it. So I think I just need to say that. It's a matter of opinion, it's a matter of taste, isn't it? I mean, it depends whether you think some subjects are beyond the pale or not, and whether that's for reasons of sympathy or reasons of unforgivability, which I think is what perhaps you're saying.
I suppose it's a question. I mean, have you ever come across a part that you did not want to play? I mean, I think that's a...
Actors do. Actors do. It's perfectly true.
I mean, not because you're frightened of it, but because you just don't... You just don't like it, and you don't like the...
Yeah. I've played the paedophile. You know, sooner or later these days you are asked to play paedophile. I mean, it's a big dramatic subject. It's
you
very, very difficult.
Seriously about it, though. Yeah. I had a friend who was in a long-running, it's in EastEnders for many, many years, playing a lovable character, and they announced to him that they'd got a brilliant idea, they were going to make his character into a paedophile, and he resigned from the series then and there, because he has two small children, and he knew he'd be attacked in the street. Mm. And he's right, he would have been. So
I did, sorry, just...
It's not really interesting.
Sorry, there's a question.
I was just wondering about the difference, following on from your really interesting point, about the difference between acting and impersonation. Mm. Because having seen My Week with Marilyn, and then just seeing the Iron Woman, Iron Lady, it's sort of discordant in a way, when you're very familiar with somebody, and you see somebody else doing it. And I don't know at what point, if it's a historical person, if there's a difference.
It is interesting, this is tricky, because there is such a thing as impersonation, which is just impersonation. I think there is. And there's identifying with the character in such a way that what comes out is a perfect impersonation of the character, but it's because of the interior work that you've done, you might say, psychological work. someone who can imitate any voice in the world is not necessarily the best actor. That's perfectly true. And there is, that you do, when you impersonate, it's true you lose something, don't you? There is a distinction here, isn't there?
Yes, there is. I think we're sort of, we're skirting around this, the huge topic of what the history play is. The British drama is absolutely peppered with the notion of the history play. And the history play takes an incident from history, real with real people doing the things that they actually did. And it spins it, twists it, it elevates it, it belittles it, but it makes it into something that casts, in some way, a kind of lamp on our own time. And that's what it ought to do. That's what Shakespeare does. And the danger, I haven't seen The Iron Lady, but the danger with the Hollywoodization of recent history is that it sanitizes it and smooths it out, and that the difficulties and the rough corners and the intellectual difficulties. Thatcher was above anything an ideologue, and from what I can gather, the ideology is completely removed from the film as it becomes a warm human drama. And I'm not sure I'd want to see that either, because you know I grew up very, very conscious of the damage she was doing to everything I held dear. So I too would feel nervous about going to see it, but I will go and see it because he's in it.
He's playing the good guy. He's playing Michael Foot. So,
if the writing is strong enough and good enough and has something to say, then surely nothing should be off limits.
No, I was going to say you ought to be able to write about anything. If you fail, you fall from a greater height. If you're tackling a subject like this, and you're going to look stupider if you fail, and if you're judged to fail, that's one thing. But I don't think there's anything off limits. I mean, I just want to finish this thing about Peter Falk, because it was a stage play, and we did a question and answer session, as we often do after performances when the audience happened to change with the audience, and I was asked a question about the character, and I tried to explain what his life was, what his feelings were, and I think I used the phrase from his point of view, and the questioner was down my throat. He said, "What do you mean, his point of view? He's a paedophile. Are you sympathetic to paedophiles?" You know, this is the point of impossibility. You know, because I have to understand the character I play, whether they're politically, sexually, psychologically, emotionally adequate. If I don't think I to be accurate, and if I don't think I can do it, I shouldn't touch it in the first place. But in the end, it's a matter of the audience's judgment, you know, as to whether you succeed in those things.
This is rather dark.
Dark notes.
But I think we will end it here. I mean, it's dark, but it's interesting because it does raise all kinds of questions. I'd like to thank particularly Michael and Philip for coming tonight. I mean, thank you so much. Thank you all, and
come to the other ones.
Come to the other ones.
Yes, come to the other ones.
In 2 weeks' time.